Good evening and welcome to Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, the academic home for the past 5 years of this year's Wreath Lecturer, Wole Soyinka. This is the fifth and final lecture of the series in which he set out to analyse the symptoms and causes of the climate of fear, which has become a defining characteristic of the world in which we live at the beginning of the 21st century. Poet, playwright and Nobel Prize winner, Professor Soyinka has spent a lifetime campaigning against tyranny. His activities led to his imprisonment in his native Nigeria and forced him into decades of exile, much of it spent here in the United States. Through the previous four lectures in this series, he's argued that the climate of fear must be assuaged through dialogue. He's maintained that while the rhetoric of political leaders may bind people together, it can also blind them to the truth. He believes that the restoration of dignity, particularly to the dispossessed peoples of the Middle East, could play a significant part in resolving the conflicts that bedevil the region, conflicts which many believe lie at the heart of the climate of fear. Tonight, in conclusion, Wole Soyinka focuses on the nature of what he calls the most dangerous being on earth, the fanatic. And he finds fanatics everywhere. With his fifth lecture entitled I Am Right, You Are Dead, would you please welcome the BBC's Wreath Lecturer 2004, Wole Soyinka.
The French nation was lately involved in a controversy over its decision to ban ostentatious symbols of religious faiths from secondary schools. I was invited to take part in that debate and readily accepted. It was a chance to openly interrogate a long-held conviction that there should be a period in the development of the young mind when the perception of differences in humanity is reduced to an absolute minimum, even if it cannot be eliminated completely. That period, it seems obvious, is that of school pupillage, where the space of instruction is cleansed of manifestations of private wealth, tastes, class, etc. The symbol, as well as practical expression of this oneness, the leveler, is of course the school uniform. Objections surfaced to the mind. The indelicate, even provocative timing, indelicate to the extent of almost sounding like a declaration of hostilities. Then the positive role of such symbols as spiritual and ethical reminders in the consciousness of youthful minds at all times, a corrective mechanism when on the verge of misconduct. In short, my mind was readying itself for the mode of dialogue, anticipating even the extension into protest demonstrations. Capitulation by the government was already a possibility. Anticipated a protracted dialogue involving the basic philosophy of education, going back to ancient times, inductions into age groups in traditional societies, etc., etc. For some, alas, such dialogue was superfluous. A hitherto unknown group vying to overtake others as the terminal censors of our time, warned the French government that it was next in line for a Madrid-style reprisal and should prepare for a season of sorrow and remorse for her perceived assault on the Islamic faith. So now, perhaps it's only a matter of time before some public target, perhaps even a school, is bombed, the contested Islamic headscarves torn off to serve as tourniquet for severed limbs, or even as shrouds. Here is an even older terminating venture. The ironically named Right to Life Crusaders in the United States, known plainly as anti-abortion militants. One such group, self-styled the Army of God, boasts a supportive network for its assassins, one that extends to Europe. The gunned-down doctors, police guards, and the occasional patients or passers-by. The network provided protection for the one who named himself Sword of God while on the run for murders. Another of the same breed of Christian fundamentalist, an ordained priest, was executed in Texas last year to a chorus of threats by his support group, that they would unleash on the American nation reprisals that would make Timothy McVeigh's crusade of vengeance like child's play. Now, Timothy McVeigh, for the uninitiated, was that remarkable zealot who was plagued by a unique social conscience that could only be stilled by blowing up a public building, one that housed both a state security department as well as an infant school. McVeigh did not profess any religion. Nevertheless, he was a zealot of his own supreme purpose, the manifestation of a private irredentism. His chosen grounds of dispute were neither ideological nor theological, but he presents us with a clear psychopathology of the zealot, one who is imbued with a self-righteousness that can only be assuaged by homicidal resolution. It moves all possible discourse away from even the dogmatic dead-end monologue of "I'm right, you are wrong," to that of "I'm right, you are dead." The issue, therefore, as I remarked in my last lecture, is not religion, but fanaticism. This, however, does not absolve either ideology or religion of responsibility for the fanatic strain to which it gives birth, one that religion even occasionally unleashes in the contest for political supremacy, then repudiates too late. It is time for us to recognize that there is no regulating mechanism for the fanatic mind once set in motion. Not for nothing do the Yoruba warn that sooner than have a monster child meet a shameful death in the marketplace, it is best that the mother strangle it in the secret recesses of the home. What this means quite simply is that the primary burden of exorcising the demon that escaped from the womb rests on the same womb that gave it birth. Today, there is urgent need for mother religion, of whatever inclination, to come to the rescue of humanity with a creative act of infanticide. It was not theocratic dictatorship, but repressions of a secular order that evoked my sense of unease when, a full generation ago, I delivered a lecture of the title "Climates of Art," to which I made reference at the introduction of these series. There is, however, a link, unsought, a sense of brutal continuity. That link was the attempted murder of the Egyptian writer Naguib Mahfouz, a Nobel Prize winner, by the way, but what matters to us is that he was, still is, a writer of his time and, most relevantly, place. Unlike a number of other creative minds trapped within the killing domain of religious terminal censors, Mahfouz did survive, a living symbol of that space of creative martyrdom that stretches today from the Afghanistan of the Taliban through Iran to North Africa, Algeria most especially. That space of fanaticism aggressively expands into other nations of traditional tolerance and balance, including mine, Nigeria. My poem Samarkand was a tribute to Naguib Mahfouz, who was fated to expand into the religious those apprehensions of the secular to which I had given voice in Climates of Art, delivered some 25 years ago. The ink of Kandahar has turned to blood. The air of ancient dynasties of letters, Khorasan, Alexandria, Timbuktu, lies sprawled in the dirt and dust of a passageway. He is no alien. No roots than his grow deeper in that marketplace. No eye roved closer home. He is that fixture in the marketplace cafe, sipping sweetened cups of mint, oblivious of the bitter one that would be served by the shadowy one, the waiter stalker. A youth fed on dreams of sarabands, of houris, doe-eyed virgins, wine and sweetmeats in the afterlife. But to this paradise, a key, the plunging knife. The 19th century black American scholar, W.E.B. Du Bois, once declared that the issue of the 20th century would be that of race. It is becoming clear that while that century may have indeed inherited and been plagued near continuously by that social issue, it was replaced towards the end by that of religion. and it is one that has not yet been addressed with the same global concern as race once was. Perhaps the Katami UNESCO initiative, to which I referred in an earlier lecture, a series of contacts titled Dialogue of Civilizations, will succeed in bringing the world to confront this lethal successor to the secular monologue. Pol Pot is dead, gone the way of those other architects of the necropolis, Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, another mixed company of both left and right. Today, the main source of the fanatic mind is religion, and its temper, one that ironically is grounded in the doctrine of submission, has grown increasingly arrogant, doctrinaire, and violent, almost in an unconscious, vengeful recompense for its apprenticeship within the spiritual principle of submission. At stake is tolerance and the place of dissent within a social order. There are, however, differences between the workings of secular intolerance and those of the theocratic, and such differences may assist us in assessing the very real threat to human freedom that the closed world of the fanatic poses to humanity. Secular ideology derives its theories from history and the material world. The mind has therefore learnt to pause occasionally and reflect on the process that links the material world to the doctrines that derive from or govern it, to test theories against those realities, be they economic, industrial, or even environmental. The dynamic totality of the real world is given rational space. Even the craving after infallibility, as in the case of Marxism, may result in the exposure of fallacies and inconsistencies, or at the least, ambiguous zones within the theory. Thus, within a secular dispensation, even under the most rigid totalitarian order, its underpinning ideology, that is the equivalent of theology, remains open to contestation. Open questioning may be suppressed, open debate may be restricted or prohibited by the state or the party of power, but the functioning of the mind, its capacity for critique, even self-criticism, never ceases. The mind remains a free agent within its own space, free to roam outside the confines of the totalitarian order, to seek and often find kindred spirits and form a conspiracy of non-believers or at least skeptics. This factor leads sooner or later to an alternative view and perhaps piecemeal erosion of the doctrinaire system. Under the theocratic sibling, however, one that derives its authority not from theories that are elicited from the material conditions of society, but from the secret spaces of revelation, this disposition of the mind towards alternative concepts is next to impossible. Curiosity succumbs to fear, often masquerading as pious submission. The theocratic order derives its mandate from the unknown. Only a chosen few are privileged to have penetrated the workings of the mind of the unknown, whose constitution, known as the scriptures, they and they alone can interpret. The fanatic that is born of this dogmatic structure of the ineffable religion is the most dangerous being on earth. Homicidal hubris is the ultimate hallmark of the fanatic. The ice pick in the neck of Leon Trotsky, ensconced in the deceptive safety of Mexico, was forged in the same furnace as the knife that sought the throat of Naguib Mahfouz. We're sometimes able to observe the intrusion of political opportunism into the workings of religious zealotry, a common enough marriage of convenience that gives birth to monstrosities. Let us only recall the sustained mob arousal in India that ended with Hindus razing down an ancient mosque in the state of Uttar Pradesh on the grounds that this centuries-old mosque had been built on the very spot where Lord Rama, a Hindu deity, first made his appearance on earth. The reverberations of that act of impiety have continued to haunt the Indian nation till today. But the immediate repercussions were orgies of killings, including the ambush of railway trains and commuter buses, the virtual religious cleansing of neighborhoods, creating ghost villages and derelict urban centers. And here, let us pause and use this episode to anticipate and silence those who, whenever an outrage linked to one religion or the other attracts amply deserved condemnation, immediately raise alarms of prejudice, sectarian hatred, and world conspiracies, tacitly claiming for such structures of faith an immunity from commentary. The world, East and West, including its official organs, UNO and UNESCO, were unambiguous in their condemnation of that crime, even as they would later unite in condemnation of the iconoclasm of the Taliban against the historic statues of Buddha. That former rebuke did not lead to any claims by Hindus that the world nursed a primordial hatred against Hinduism or had entered into a conspiracy to eradicate that religion from the world. On a personal level, I found myself sufficiently exercised to note the event in my poetic calendar titled 12 Canticles for the Zealot, published in Samarkand and other markets I've known. It goes thus. A god is nowhere born, yet everywhere, but Rama's sect rejects the fine distinction. The designated spot is sanctified, not for piety, but for dissolution of yours from mine, politics of hate and forced exchange, peace for a moment's rapture. They turn a mosque to rubble, stone by stone, condemned usurper of Lord Rama's vanished spot of dreamt epiphany. Now a cairn of stones usurps a dream of peace. Can they dream peace in iconoclast Uttar Pradesh? Few spots in the world today are exempt from the depredations of the fanatic. I believe it should be possible to view the bombing of innocents in the United States, Bali, Casablanca, Madrid, or anywhere else in the same way. It is untenable to claim that because those mass killers implicated and persist in invoking the banner of Islam, seeking legitimation and a killing rapture from that religion, that Islam is therefore indicted. Equally, is it unacceptable to claim that any condemnation of the act or pursuit of the criminals reveals hatred of the religion? A world in which a powerful organization like NATO goes to battle against the Christian Serbs on behalf of a battered Muslim population and brings the head of their violators to justice before an international tribunal is not a world that is prejudiced against Islam, Christendom, or Buddhism, and the propagators of such doctrines are merely disingenuous. In any case, the Christian world is not one, neither is Islamic, nor do their combined authority speak for the entire world. But the world of the fanatic is one, and it cuts across all religions and vocations. The tributaries that feed the cesspool of fanaticism may ooze from sources separated by history, clime, and race, by injustices and numerous privations, but they arrive at the same destination, the zone of unquestioning certitude. The zealot is one that creates a supreme being or purpose in his or her own image, then executes the orders of that solipsistic device in lofty alienation from and utter contempt of society and community. We on the African continent, whose people were decimated in a time of our own troubled peace in Kenya and Tanzania, our soil violated by one of the earliest acts of aerial sabotage that scattered human limbs over the earth of Niger, have a special stake in this. The black freedom fighters of southern Sudan, locked in a brutal war of over three decades against an Islamic regime, a genocidal war that has claimed at least 100,000 times more lives and overseen 1,000 times greater destruction of a people, an environment, and a culture than in the Middle East, have not resorted to accusing the Islamic or Arab world of a conspiracy against the black race. They have focused on the quest for liberation from a specified, localized, theocratic, and often racist order, against which they have raised charges of genocide that remain largely ignored by the Western world and by the United Nations. We do not hear from the leaders of that struggle any proposition of the division of the world into the African world against all others. The combatants have not moved to set the bazaars and monuments of Medina on fire or burn Japanese infants in their cribs. Not even the historic, still ongoing in parts, denigration of African religions and cultures, or indeed the memory of both European and Arab enslavement of the African peoples, has elicited this inflammatory agenda. The dead-end dogmatism of I'm right, you are wrong, has circled back since the contest of ideologies and once again attained its apotheosis of I am right, you are dead. The monologue of unilateralism constantly aspires to the mantle of the chosen and, of course, further dichotomizes the world, inviting us on pain of consequences to choose between them and us. We must, in other words, reject the pronouncement of a George Bush in the ultimatum, you are either with us and against the terrorists, or you are on the side of the terrorists, just as strongly as we repudiate Osama bin Laden's the world is now clearly divided into two, the world of the followers of Islam against those of infidels and unbelievers. Could the United States have responded differently immediately after September 11? Perhaps not. Hindsight is a most unreliable judge of such decisions, and those circumstances were clearly unprecedented. Did that nation, however, have to embark on that avoidable path that led remorselessly into Iraq? More specifically, and with no complication of hindsight, why were the weapons inspectors of the United Nations ordered out of Iraq in submission to the will of one nation, especially at a moment when Saddam Hussein had openly submitted himself to the authority of that very institution? Let us turn to our present deadline. It is still the second millennium, the so-called era of the global village. Concretely, it is the era in which the world has attempted to put in place, after many blunders and derelictions of responsibilities, international courts of tribunals for crimes against humanity. It is an era in which former heads of state are hauled up for crimes against their own peoples and against others, from Chile to Rwanda. It is the era of the strategy of near globally upheld sanctions, not always successful, we know, and sometimes excruciatingly slow in the ability to produce the desired results. It is nevertheless the era of newly invigorated possibilities, a new global relevance for the organ called the United Nations. Indeed, perhaps it was stemming from this same consciousness, an attempt to impress upon the world the critical necessity of such an organ in the new millennium, that the Nobel establishment, in its centennial anniversary, chose to honor that organization and its Secretary General with a Peace Prize. We cannot deny or gloss over some of the failures to live up to world expectations, to its founding ideas and the needs of humanity. We are only too keenly aware of the costly consequences in global trust and in human lives of some of those failures. Nevertheless, we are doomed to despair if we failed to acknowledge also its many achievements and to accept the fact that it is the only organ in the world that has unquestioned authority of intervention in troubled spots. Unilateral action or the appropriation of a global duty of response by any one nation serves only to diminish the United Nations. That the greatest culprit in this respect should be one of such powerful achievements as the United States One that is also host to that organization physically on its own soil only denotes an innovation of global vision. That the United States has a capacity for technological, military, and economic leadership is not in dispute. What the United States lacks is philosophical leadership, despite its formidable reserves of original thinkers. The atrocity of September 11 was a crime against the world, against humanity. It was thus a moment for the United States to have demonstrated her readiness to reinforce the structures that take a global view of such criminality. The U.S. had the option of placing her formidable capabilities under the moral authority of the United Nations, instilling in her own people the imperatives of a global approach to justice. America strikes back. No, this resorts to what we identified in an earlier talk as rhetorical hysteria was not what the world needed to see emblazoning the screens of American television hour after hour, day after day, and week after week, as the United States gathered its strength to avenge a crime that was committed on its soil. Such orchestration of mood was bound to lead sooner or later to the quagmire of Iraq, lose its ethical moorings in the original cause, and degenerate into an open-ended career of aggressive pursuit that would translate as America strikes on and on and on and on, its lethal array of weaponry poised to awe and shock. If certain acts against humanity appear to place their perpetrators beyond dialogue, we must still embrace interrogation, that is, self-interrogation. In what way, in turn, have we contributed to the making of such a moment? Failure to do this limits the long-term effectiveness of response and brackets us with the mentality of the fanatic who literally never seeks to recover, indeed is incapable of recovering a long-receded moment of doubt, the zone of possible choices, of the potentials of the routes not taken. That quest is open and universal. What nature of an environment ensured the stabbing of a Naguib Mahfouz? Has Marxism triumphed since the killing of Leon Trotsky? Was peaceful coexistence promoted by the demolition of the mosque in Uttar Pradesh? Has the assassination of Sheikh Yassin made the world any safer? What kind of morality is it that turns a 14-year-old child into a walking bomb? Does a supposed wall of defense concretize hope or despair across the Middle East? Why did the woman writer, Taslim Nasreen, become a fugitive from her home in Pakistan? Our theme is fanaticism. So let the last word be on behalf of that doubly endangered species, writer and woman, standing in for the disdained of the world, seeking equality for their kind. Some words are coarse, obscene, indecent. They make a case for censorship. Such words as pagan, heathen, infidel, unbeliever, kafiri, etc. The cleric swears he'll sweep the streets clean of the unclean, armed with book and beard. Both turn kindling, but overturn the law of physics. For the fire consumes all but the arsonist. He lives to preach another day. The promised beast of the apocalypse left me unbeliever till a rambling cleric apportioned death on CNN. Surely that devil's instrument on Taslim Nasreen. She spoke of an equalizing God, androgynous, who deals ambidextrous with the left and right. Thank you very much.
Well, Ashiwanka, thank you very much indeed. So, On the one hand is the impenetrable world of the fanatic who has utter contempt for society. On the other, says the professor, is the most powerful nation in the world which lacks philosophical leadership. There is, he suggests, a moral equivalence between the rallying cries of the two, between the rhetoric of George Bush and Osama bin Laden. Well, I invite our audience now here at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, to examine and test that thesis. Who would like to put our first question?
I'm Deepika Bari in the English department at Emory. Professor Shoinka, if you're right, we're all dead. If you're right that openness to dialogue is the answer, and if you're right that fanaticism, by definition, is beyond dialogue, then is there any way forward?
The world has not given up on dialogue. I'm merely emphasizing the fact that dialogue seems to be losing out at present to the resolve of the fanatic.
But are we condemned to living with this climate of fear now? Is that what you're saying? Will we just get used to it, in a sense, do you feel, in the way that we got used to living with the Cold War?
Yes, I'm afraid so. We have to, of course, transcend the fear, but we must recognize that we are living with the factor of a resolve in some quarters to create a climate of fear. Yes.
But if the formulation is that fanaticism is outside of, it's just outside of dialogue, and if what we're supposed to do is dialogue internally somehow, what's a dialogue without a partner?
Well, fanaticism is a carbuncle on the skin of religion, and it's up to the body of religion to excise that carbuncle, principally. But you will dialogue with religion, you will dialogue with ideology, with the mainstream, rational members of that society of religion or that society of ideology.
But you've said it's impenetrable. These people are not willing to dialogue. They will not speak. You can talk to yourself, interrogate yourself as much as you like, but where's it going to get you with the fanatic?
The fanatic does not exist in a vacuum. The fanatic settles. It's a parasite. A very vicious parasite that settles on a certain body, whether it's a body of ideology or a body of religion. And the primary function, the primary duty of religion or ideology is to expel from within its body that unacceptable face of its own faith. Those of us on the outside must assist those religions, for instance, which breed these fanatics, also to expel their own errant members. So I'm not saying dialogue with a fanatic. I'm not personally interested in dialoguing with a fanatic. If the fanatic comes to kill me, I consider it my duty to try and kill him first.
Gentlemen.
My name is J.B. Tarter. I'm a student here at Emory University. Is it not morally outrageous to argue that Bush and bin Laden are on the same moral plane, considering the goal of the United States and the Bush administration is freedom, democracy, and prosperity, whereas the goal of bin Laden is destruction, mayhem, and oppression?
You used the word moral. I never said at any time they were on the same moral level. I said that they shared certain traits, and those traits respond to the expression fundamentalist thinking. Right? There's a difference between placing people on a fundamentalist level and placing them on the same moral level.
But my question is, doesn't your logic lead to just a morally offensive argument, saying that these two individuals, a mass murderer and a world leader, are even on the same plane? Is that morally offensive?
Let me remind you of something, that war is very ugly by any means. There were children killed in the attacks of Osama bin Laden. There were children killed, incinerated, disfigured also by an unnecessary war in Iraq, a war that was not justified.
I'll take the gentleman there with the gray hair in the center there.
Jim Tysinger. I live in DeKalb County. I'm a graduate of Georgia Tech, not Emory. The United Nations passed two resolutions condemning Saddam Hussein. That is similar to what happened in before 39 when Chamberlain went into Munich and gave away Czechoslovakia and came back home waving a piece of paper saying peace in our time. At what time should a nation take arms up to defend its own rights and what it has been expressed by the United Nations.
Yeah. I think the comparison doesn't quite work. Saddam Hussein bluffed for a very long time. When he saw that the chips were down, he said, all right, no more no-go areas. Please, everything is wide open. The palaces, the gardens, and so on, please come in, inspect. Hitler never said to Chamberlain, come and inspect my flying bombs. You know, he never did, you know. And my point is that...
That is true.
Yes.
But Saddam Hussein kicked our people out inspecting it.
No, I've already said that at the beginning, Saddam Hussein was a great bluffer. He bluffed, he ranted, he dared, he did it before. But when he saw that the United Nations was resolute, and this was also backed by the threat which came from the United States, one mustn't deny that, he then said, all right, the game is up. I bow to the resolutions of the United Nations.
How do you know he's telling the truth?
Just a minute. How do we know he was not telling the truth? You know, the important thing is that Saddam Hussein said, come in.
But he had a track record of incorrigibility. Why do you choose to believe him at that point when you discover you couldn't believe him before?
He had a track record. These weapons inspectors were being prevented, even at that stage, from carrying out the functions, the orders of the United Nations. And suddenly, Saddam Hussein said, all right, go ahead and carry out your task. Those inspectors should have been allowed to continue with their job and give the lie to Saddam Hussein, after which the United Nations would then move. But they were not allowed to carry out their job.
Quick last comment to the gentleman who was speaking.
Yeah. I would just take exceptions to what you just stated, because while they came in, since the first time they let the inspectors come in and kicked them out, by that time they had taken their weapons of mass destruction and done something with it. Let me tell you, weapons of mass destruction are store-bought items. Anybody can buy nuclear weapons today. They don't have to have them on hand. They can buy them today, as is proven in Libya, that they bought them off the shelf.
We're coming towards the end, and I've got still quite a lot of hands up.
Completely in the back here.
I'm coming to you. I promise you. There's a lot of hands knocking around here, and I'm coming to the back there. But just thank you.
I'd hate to think that it was my use of fanatical tactics that.
I was wondering whether
I
to suggest
him.
That,
well,
sir. He, but so,
I
mean, give us your name before you go.
My name is Biodun Jay for Cornell University. How do you negotiate the gray area, the gray zone between fanaticism and revolutionary passions for justice? For instance, to the slogan, I'm light, you're dead, if you can't oppose that to, I'm dying, but I'm going to get you first. You know, because there's a very gray area, especially in the Middle East regions on both sides.
Absolutely. In all human interrelation and conflicts, there are gray areas. But I think it is possible very often to identify the fanatic. I absolutely agree that there are gray areas, and at the same time, I've emphasized not only the possibility, but in fact the responsibility of identifying those who do not fall within the gray areas. I have said, for instance, and I think you will agree, oh, well, maybe you will disagree. You might like to call Osama bin Laden a visionary. I do not. Maybe he once was a visionary, but now I think he's a fanatic in his own cause. Anybody who, for instance, declares that there is absolutely no meeting point between one point of view and another is already a fanatic in that cause.
Agreed.
Whether he acts out the gory role that we're now familiar with of the fanatic, or he merely sits quietly in his house. If I may go back again to Nigeria, I know one person who began as a Orthodox, straightforward Muslim. And the next thing we knew, he was forbidding any non-Muslim to come into his house. Now, what he wanted to do is with his wife, who was a Christian, I have no idea. But she certainly was not allowed to receive even her relations anymore in that house. I think at that point, that is not a gray area. A line has been drawn there. And I think we have a moral responsibility to recognize when lines have been drawn. We can argue over the gray areas, but I think from time to time we discover, sometimes too late, that we've been in company of the fanatic.
I'm afraid, despite the number of hands we have, we do have to end it there. I wonder, because this is the end of the fifth lecture in the series of five, whether I couldn't ask you just one wrapping up question, as it were, Wally. You know, so many problems that the world has suffered in our own lifetimes, whether it's been apartheid or whether it's been communism or whether it's been the Cold War, in the end they have seemed insurmountable, but ultimately they have proved to be surmountable. Do you think it's possible, although you've said this climate of fear under which we currently exist is the worst kind of fear in your lifetime, worse, you've said, than the Cold War, than the Second World War, do you think that this kind of nihilistic fanaticism is the ultimate test of civilized structures?
I wouldn't say it's the ultimate test, but it's certainly one of the toughest that the world has ever faced, because this is a hydra-headed and totally unpredictable form of menace. It's a menace which has, which doesn't believe in taking prisoners and doesn't believe in allies. If, for instance, I had a cause for which I needed your support, I would ensure that I did not in any way menace you or jeopardize your people. The kind of menace we're talking about simply does not give a damn. And so it seems a very intractable form of menace. But I believe that ultimately humanity has a way of settling down eventually to dialogue. After we battered one another and pulverized the evidence of our civilization, and we then come together and say how stupid we've been all along. And I think that will happen.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. That brings us to the end of the Reith Lectures for this year. I hope that our audience here in Atlanta, as well as those listening at home, would agree that this series has fulfilled the vision for public service broadcasting of the man in whose honour the lectures were named. That's to say, they've informed, educated and entertained. It was all and everything Lord Reith asked. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed, and thank you again to our Reith Lecturer 2004, Wally Schoenberg.